Navidad, feliz Navidad, feliz Navidad, próspero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad, feliz Navidad, feliz Navidad, próspero año y felicidad.
It's the Sound Off Christmas Show, episode 251, here on SEScoops.com. Sunday, December 23rd, 2012. I am the Solemn Monster. Happy holidays to everybody, and a very Merry Christmas for those of you who celebrate. My thanks to everybody who joined us for SE Scoops Live last Monday before Raw. Noah Mark, Brian Blade, and myself had fun, a lot of fun doing the show, taking your phone calls, as always. And those of you who missed out, fear not. You can now get SE Scoops Live on demand. You can go to SEScoops.com and check out the sidebar. Or just click on the audio section on the main page, and you can stream the show right after you're done listening to this. Don't listen to that first. Listen to this. I watched 8 hours of wrestling in 3 days, 10 hours of wrestling total for the week, and that does not even include main event or tribute to the troops, which apparently included a Miz TV segment with Kermit the Frog. I couldn't deal with the thought of that, so I passed. But still, that's a lot of wrestling, folks. And the good news is that it was largely great wrestling, so I really can't complain. We'll talk about Raw. We'll talk about Super SmackDown. We'll talk about Impact Wrestling as well. But first, I was in attendance, along with Brian Blade, at the brand new Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York, last Sunday for WWE's Tables, Ladders, and Chairs pay-per-view. And if you haven't heard by now, it was an awesome show, as I'm sure many of you have already heard, or you saw it yourself. Not a perfect show. No show can be perfect with a Miz TV segment on it, but the two main events were outstanding, and there were several good to very good matches on the undercard. Hot crowd. I've had the good fortune of attending some memorable WWE shows this year. WrestleMania 28, of course, in Miami. 70,000 people. One of the biggest money main events in wrestling history. I think I may have had more fun even at Raw the next night at the American Airlines Arena. The fans in Miami were just amazing that night. That's still the most fun I've had at a wrestling show. Brock Lesnar made his big return that night, even though Daniel Bryan was the star of the show. You know, yes chants in the hallways, yes chants in the parking garage, yes chants outside the building. Very lucky to have been part of that. And now I can add TLC to that list, a show that the general consensus seems to be that it may be WWE's best show of the year. I have since gone back and watched the six-man TLC match. Actually, I watched it twice. That's how much I enjoyed it. And it was every bit as awesome on TV as it was live. But I have to say I have yet to watch the entire event back on television. So it's hard for me to compare the experience since I was there live. I'm a bit biased. I didn't have the benefit or the detriment, as it were, of commentary. And you know, perhaps the crowd reactions weren't as loud on TV as they were in the building. But to me, for show of the year, when it comes to pure action, it's really between TLC and Extreme Rules from April. You know, Extreme Rules really had three excellent matches and a fourth in Randy Orton and Kane that I don't remember being terrible. In fact, it may have been one of the better matches the two of them had. And they had some not-so-good ones, too. But on that show, I think they had a pretty good match. I may do a year-end review type deal again next week on episode 252. I'm not 100% on that yet. But two of my candidates for possible match of the year were from the Extreme Rules show. You know, the 2 out of 3 falls match between Sheamus and Daniel Bryan for the world title, which was awesome. If you have never seen that match, you owe it to yourself to check it out. And Brock Lesnar versus John Cena, which was unlike any other WWE pay-per-view main event I've ever seen, quite frankly, and had me on the edge of my seat. I can't remember the last time a WWE match did that for me. Plus, you had a CM Punk Chris Jericho street fight that was better, arguably, than their WrestleMania match. So, for that reason alone, I'd probably give Extreme Rules the slight edge, but TLC is right behind it. Just a great night of wrestling. And the other thing that makes this show so special, wrestling aside, this really felt like a changing of the guard. Somewhat. You know, I'm not going to fool myself into thinking that, you know, guys like Dolph Ziggler and The Shield and Antonio Cesaro are going to be headlining every pay-per-view from here on out. You know, I mean, next month, for God's sake, we have The Rock wrestling in the main event. But this was a breakout night for Dean Ambrose, Seth Rollins, Roman Reigns. They made 3 stars in one night. They booked them perfectly. They weren't made to look weak. And in the end, they won, which was the right outcome. They didn't have to cheat to win either. I mean, in the context of a TLC match, they played by the rules, and they earned the victory, fair and square. And I can tell you, the fans in the Barclays Center were believers by the time this thing was over. You know, many of us already knew how good Rollins and Ambrose were because we still remember seeing these guys wrestle in front of a much smaller crowds, you know, at the Manhattan Center or, you know, B.B. King's club in Times Square, where Dean Ambrose, back when he was still John Moxley on the independent scene, he made his final independent appearance at that venue before going to developmental. And by the way, his opponent in that match last year, future TNA World Heavyweight Champion Austin Aries. But we have been starved for fresh new talent, I think, for so long that seeing these 3 guys succeed and thrive in this type of environment was just such a great feeling. I'm really happy for those guys. I really am. And then seeing Dolph Ziggler standing tall to close out a pay-per-view, the first time that's ever happened for him, and to do so over John Cena, no less, the face of the company, again, it was the right outcome. And I'm happy for Dolph. God knows he's been ready for a while now. I don't know when he's cashing in the briefcase. He's got until July. That'll be a year since he won it. But to me, this was the biggest statement of his career, even more so than winning the briefcase the first time. He essentially won it a second time on this show, and to me, he made more of an impact doing that than he did last summer. It meant more this time. I didn't like the idea of having him put his briefcase on the line going into the pay-per-view. I made that very clear, largely because I just didn't trust them to do the right thing. But they did, and you heard the reaction in the building when he won. You know, New York fans do tend to go against the grain, but that's only because, you know, either they're rebelling against the system or, you know, for shoving something down our throats that we don't like, or when people recognize real talent. And if you have real talent and you work your ass off, heel or face, the people are going to respect you for it. And that's what we saw at TLC. And on top of that, there were a few crazy bumps and spots that were just incredible to see live, including one that were, I think, very lucky somebody didn't get killed, and I think you know the one I'm talking about. We'll get to that as we go along here. But let's go through this here. Live experience from TLC. This was my first event at the new Barclays Center. I was very impressed. Very nice building. Felt a bit smaller than Madison Square Garden. I'd guess you could fit about, I don't know, 15, 16,000 people in there for a wrestling event. I know at the Garden, for a house show without the television setup, capacity is about 19,000 or so. You know, they were calling the event a sellout. It may well have been. It was pretty packed. Very easy ride for me. I can literally just hop on the train, take it about, I don't know, 6 or 7 stops, come above ground, and the arena is literally staring me in the face. You know, you walk up the steps from the train station, and there's the marquee that says Barclays Center. And you know, once I got to the train station, that's about, I don't know, 10-minute ride. Took about another 15 minutes or so when I was there. So very easy ride. When the show went off the air, by the way, John Cena cut a promo. He mentioned that they would be splitting their time from now on between Madison Square Garden and the Barclays Center. It probably gives the company more leverage, too, I would imagine. I know about a year or two ago there was a period where WWE would not run Madison Square Garden. I don't know if they need to pay a renter's fee for the building or some sort of a fee of some kind, and the owners were just jacking up the price or what the issue was. But the cost of running the building was apparently preventing them from running there. And things seem to be okay now. But now that they've got another building in the area that they can run, I think that MSG would be less likely to give WWE any headaches going forward. Show opened with a dark match. David Otunga. Who has now the distinction of being the first ever WWE performer to be introduced at an event in that building. So there's an obscure trivia note for you. He wrestled JTG, who got an enormous pop when he came out. Actually, I think it was more for his theme song, which starts off with Brooklyn. That's probably why he got a big pop. But WWE did something very uncharacteristic on this show. They gave the hometown boys wins in their hometown. JTG pinned Otunga. And, of course, the Brawler got a big win later on in the night. So, very, very cool for them to do that. For the pre-show, they had the Santa's Helper Diva Battle Royal. My thanks to Brian Blade, by the way, for reminding me to bust out my stopwatch. I clocked it at about 5 minutes, 21 seconds. Naomi of the Funkadactyls got the upset win. Eve Torres was at ringside. She nailed Caitlyn, walked off. Naomi was able to eliminate Caitlyn for the win. I talked about fresh blood on this show. You could add Naomi to that list, even if it was only for one night. They didn't go with the obvious Layla or Caitlyn win, and they gave it to somebody new. You know, I liked it. And Naomi is actually very good. If you remember her from NXT Season 3, which was probably the last NXT season I actually did watch episodes from, was with the women. You know, I don't know why they don't let her wrestle more. She's very good, and maybe now they will. She wasn't... I wouldn't say she was great, but then again, you can't really fault her. They haven't really let her wrestle much lately. She busted out some pretty cool moves, very athletic. Cameron, when she's not drunk, apparently, is busy studying tapes of Melina versus Alicia Fox, so we won't talk about her. They opened the pay-per-view with a very classy 26-bell tribute, a salute to the victims of the elementary school shootings in Connecticut. It was my first time at a live event with any sort of salute like this, very somber, but a move that WWE should be commended for. As should TNA, by the way. Worth mentioning that on Impact this week, TNA did have a message up on the screen at the beginning of the show, a show that was taped a few weeks ago, I believe before the tragedy took place, and they had a note also at the beginning of their show, so it's very classy. Opening match was a tables match, Rey Mysterio Sin Cara against the Rhodes Scholars. Damian Sandow came out, he got a tremendous reaction, by the way, as did Cody's mustache. He ran down the hipster population in Brooklyn. Many of us in the crowd actually agreed with him, which only made him more of a babyface. Really good opener, the perfect match to set the tone for this show. People were into it. The finish of the match was unbelievable. You know, as incredible and dangerous as it may have looked on television, magnify that by 5 in the arena. Sin Cara, he attempted to do a springboard from the apron, where he propels himself to the top rope and he jumps in. And once he got up on the rope, Cody Rhodes came from out of nowhere in the ring and just shoved him backwards. And Sin Cara took this amazing bump where he flew through the air. He appeared to overshoot one of the two tables that were placed on the outside next to each other, and he crashed through the other one. I mean, it just looked sick. Just a great, great finish, if not a bit dangerous. And at this point, I was 0-1 in my predictions. I ended up going 4-2, which actually isn't bad at all. Things were not looking too good for me the first couple of matches on the card, but I did rebound well by the end, so I just wanted to make a note of that. The great Antonio Cesaro beat R-Truth to retain the U.S. title. Cesaro was very beloved, no different than any match you would see on Raw. Very disappointed to not see Cesaro use the Swiss Death. Although he did deliver an uppercut to the back of Truth's head before giving him the neutralizer, but it was kind of anticlimactic, to be honest with you. After the show, R-Truth went on Twitter, and he posted a photo of his knee, which apparently was injured in the match. And I can't figure out where the injury would have occurred, but maybe that's why we didn't see the big uppercut Cesaro normally uses in his matches. Maybe they rushed to the finish because Truth was hurt. I don't know. But if you take a look at the photo, just... really nasty. Just looked like his skin just got ripped right off his leg. And he was wearing pants, too. It's not like he wears tights where his skin is exposed. I have no idea what happened, but just disgusting. They brought out the Miz TV set for a segment on this show. A show, mind you, that we paid to see. I mean, well, I paid because I was in the building. But you people paid, too, if you watched it on pay-per-view. And it was hilarious in the building watching them just throw the couches into the ring. You know, the arena went dark. I think they were showing a promo before Miz came out. But in the arena, they load those couches into the ring like they're just garbage. They just throw them in there. I mean, they may as well be garbage. Nobody ever sits on the goddamn things. Miz came out. He introduced 3MB. This segment was a gigantic waste of time until 3MB started bullying the Spanish announcers for seemingly no reason at all. And this brought out Ricardo Rodriguez to their defense. 3MB started pushing him around. This brought out Alberto Del Rio. No music either, which was a nice touch. You know, these days people usually are... I guess people are like trapped in a force field backstage until they hear their theme music play. Then they come running out. Del Rio, he cleaned house. He went to town on 3MB. People cheered this. I just talked about a possible Del Rio babyface turn on the Sound Off last week. and now this. So they obviously didn't waste any time. This had been rumored for a couple of weeks now. Although on the Raw show they taped that airs this week. This is a minor spoiler alert here for those of you who don't want to know. On Raw this coming Monday night, Del Rio apparently is right back to being a heel. So I don't know what's going on, but I'm sure he must have been thrilled to be teamed with The Miz on this show, who he hates. Del Rio hates The Miz, for real. As does CM Punk. As do quite a few people backstage, from what I understand. This whole segment was just to set up a six-man tag later in the show. The second one, actually, on the show. Miz would not reveal who their partner would be. The fans chanted Zack Ryder's name. Poor Zack Ryder went on Twitter and said that he wasn't even at the building. The office had had emailed him earlier telling him his services were not needed. So that sucks. Kofi Kingston pinned Wade Barrett with the Trouble in Paradise to retain the Intercontinental title. This made even less sense, given that they had Barrett lose to R-Truth in like 2 minutes on Raw last week. Well, 2 weeks ago, I guess. I assume Wade is going to get the title soon, but they just wanted to give the fans something to cheer about, given who was going over in the two main events. Still, you know, I would have had Wade win the championship here, but, I mean, that's just me. Then we got a CM Punk promo from up in one of the skyboxes. Very good promo, actually. I especially liked how he pointed out how stupid Ryback was for injuring him and therefore getting his title match changed as a result. Man's got a point. Can't deny that. Ryback may need to ask Kane and Daniel Bryan for Dr. Shelby's contact information. He may have some anger management issues of his own that need to be addressed. Then we had the match of the night, perhaps even the match of the year, at least in WWE. Ryback and Hell No against The Shield. I was shocked they were putting this on in the middle of the show, but given the AJ turn later, I guess they wanted to save that for last. Daniel Bryan was insanely over with the Brooklyn crowd. Tons of yes chants, just shades of Miami all over again. Ryback, not so much. Crowd really didn't react at all to his entrance. There were a lot of Goldberg chants, especially after that one spot where he speared, I forgot who it was. It may have been Ambrose, but just, it was a total Goldberg spot. I don't know why they would have had him do that. But they were loudly chanting, "Feed me more," 2 seconds later when he nailed, again, I think it was Ambrose with the meat hook clothesline. So the Shield actually entered through the crowd right next to our section, so we saw them go by. You know, what can really be said about this match other than it was awesome? Just pure mayhem from start to finish, never really a dead moment in the entire match. It was long, too, went over 20 minutes. You know, dare I say, not to take anything away from our esteemed WWE champion, but this was probably a much better match than Punk vs. Ryback would have been. You know, they say things happen for a reason. There was a really cool spot where Rollins and Ambrose had a table laid flat across the top rope in the corner. They climbed onto it and delivered a superplex to Daniel Bryan. Shield gave Ryback another powerbomb through the announce table, which this was the best unintentional comedy of the night because Ryback must have been laid out on the floor for like 10 minutes. It certainly felt that long. He just laid there and laid there and laid there. And he flopped around a little bit like a fish. It was just comical how much this one powerbomb took out of Ryback. And later on, they brawled down the aisle by the set where they had the ladders and the tables just kind of sitting around. And we were fortunate enough to be on the side of the arena closest to where Seth Rollins took his bump of death off the ladder when Ryback yanked him off. And Rollins went crashing down through a table like a madman. We didn't see his head striking the second table. You know, from where we were sitting, I couldn't even tell that the tables were stacked up. I just assumed there were two tables side by side. And watching it on TV, these tables were stacked. So that makes it even more amazing. And Rollins crashed through one table, missed the other. Just insane stuff. And Kane had been speared through the barricade on the outside of the ring earlier in the match, and he was literally buried in debris. So he was out of the picture. And the finish, Roman Reigns gives Daniel Bryan a powerbomb with some assistance from Dean Ambrose, through a table, and he pinned him. Roman Reigns pinning the former World Heavyweight Champion clean in the middle of the ring. A great, fun match. And like I said, if it isn't WWE's best match of the year, and the word best is very subjective, I know, if it isn't number one, it's in my top three for 2012. Just much respect to everybody involved in this. And you know you're having fun when 20 minutes go by and you still don't want the match to end. And to me, personally, you know, I wanted to give it a few days. It's situations like this where it's a good thing that the sound off, you know, isn't. I don't record until the weekend because I have time to digest some things and not just react instantaneously, perhaps with a touch of hyperbole, shall we say. And it's been almost a week now, roughly, and I can honestly say that it's matches like this that make me really happy to be a wrestling fan. It's just fun. That's really what wrestling should be. It should be fun. When this match was over, we had fun. People were high-fiving in the audience, and the heels won, no less. And people were just very happy with this. And the wrestlers involved in the match should be as well. This was top-notch stuff. Eve Torres pinned Naomi to retain her Divas title. 3 minutes, 5 seconds was the time. Second Divas stopwatch of the night, by the way, which is a record. That means the women had a combined ring time of 8 minutes and 26 seconds on this show, which may as well be Sting versus Flair at the first Clash of the Champions in that 45-minute draw. Funny little aside here, Brian Blade, who, as many of you know, especially if you listen to our interview with Daniel Bryan on Sound Off 212, Brian is a vegan. Brian Blade, not Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan is now an ex-vegan. He used to be a vegan. He is no longer. But anyway, vegan though he may be, we all have our weaknesses. And when Eve came out, his chance of feed me more for Ryback quickly turned to feed me Eve. To which I responded, you know, dude, you're a vegan. You don't eat meat. And he said he was willing to make a one-time exception. Can't say I blame him. Eve also happens to have some of the most honest lyrics to a theme song in all of WWE. She looks good to me. Indeed she does. Big Show beat Sheamus in a chairs match, retained the World Heavyweight Championship. This match died a death live, at least until the end. People just did not care about this match at all. Lots of boring chants in the middle of the match. I heard it came off a lot better on TV. Again, I have not gone back and watched this on TV. Apparently it was better than their Survivor Series match, but, you know, in the arena, it was just very quiet. Really, the first match or two coming off that TLC match was just going to die a death no matter what. Finish came after Big Show pulled out a gigantic chair, like a chair on steroids, out from underneath the ring. He nailed Sheamus with it for the pin. It was actually a pretty lame finish in the arena because it didn't look like he nailed Sheamus very hard with the chair at all, and then he just pinned him clean. I mean, it was a chairs match. Based on the rules, Big Show did not cheat. He just used a bigger chair, and he won. I don't know how you justify Sheamus getting another title shot after this. You know, you could say the same thing about Wade Barrett. If at first you don't succeed, who cares? You'll just keep getting title shots until you do. I guess that's the new philosophy in WWE. The best part was Big Show left. When he left, he did so not just with the championship, but with the chair. He took the chair with him. He did not want anybody else using his chair. And I can't say I blame him. Lots of people thinking Dolph Ziggler might cash in his Money in the Bank at this point and then be forced to defend the title in the main event against John Cena, but obviously that did not happen. We had Del Rio, Miz, and Brooklyn Brawler. Yes, the Brooklyn Brawler was their surprise partner, which I was very excited about. What a trio that is. They beat 3MB with the Brawler using a Boston Crab, of all things. He used a Boston Crab to beat Jinder Mahal. I guess on commentary they refer to it as a Brooklyn Crab. That's what we were calling it. But still, quite brazen having the Brooklyn Brawler win with a Boston Crab. Those of you who are not familiar with the Boston-New York rivalry in baseball, that won't mean much to you. But trust me, that took guts for them to do that. And great to see the Brawler get a nod. You know, I talked about last week on episode 250. You know, I said you can't have the first ever Brooklyn pay-per-view and not have the Brooklyn Brawler. It's impossible. And I can now say that I have been witness live in the arena to two of the Brooklyn Brawler's biggest career highlights. Actually, they are his two biggest career highlights. What am I talking about? You know, I guess him appearing at WrestleMania 5 with Bobby Heenan against the Red Rooster, perhaps that would be a highlight for him. But the two I'm talking about are TLC, obviously, which you know, he himself went on Twitter and said it was one of the greatest moments of his life, which is sad. And the other would be a house show at Madison Square Garden back in 1998. I happened to be at that show, and it featured the Brooklyn Brawler getting a WWF title match against the champion, Shawn Michaels. I guess the Brawler had won a Battle Royal at the Garden a couple months earlier to earn this title shot. And it wasn't a bad match either. I mean, Shawn Michaels was involved, so obviously, even Shawn Michaels' worst match, if you kind of grade it on a scale, would probably still be considered a good match. Shawn gave him some near falls, I think, if I remember correctly. It was something else. So I have the dubious distinction of having been there live for both of these great achievements for the guy. Main event was the Money in the Bank ladder match, Dolph Ziggler and John Cena. This was the biggest match of Dolph Ziggler's career. He delivered. Both men delivered. Very good ladder match. Not nearly as good as the TLC match earlier in the night, but it would be, I think, unfair to compare the two of them. This was excellent in its own right. The crowd was staunchly behind Dolph Ziggler. Cena got the usual boos. A couple of fun spots here, including one where Ziggler was on Cena's back. He had him in a sleeper, all while Cena was still climbing the ladder. They fell over through a table. Cena had blood coming from his eye earlier in the match. I don't know where it happened, but I could see the referees on the outside putting on the rubber gloves. So I figured somebody was cut. Thankfully, they did not stop the match for it. The other memorable spot in the match was the visual of Ziggler on the ladder as Cena hoisted it up over his head. He teased tossing the ladder out of the ring with Ziggler on top. I guess maybe trying for the first ever ladder attitude adjustment, but Ziggler slipped off and avoided certain death. Cena is he is one strong SOB. And he also tried to debut his sixth move of doom on this show. Yes, John Cena attempted a new move. Of all things to try, he went for a standing Hurricanrana. And contrary to Eve's theme song, this did not look good to me. But I give him credit for trying. He tried. He did try. That's all you can ask for. I mean, if you have a kid and they try to do something and fail, you don't point and laugh at them. Well, maybe you do if you're a shitty parent, but most parents wouldn't do that. They would say something encouraging to that child to make them feel better about their effort and tell them they did their best. John Cena did his best, and he failed. He failed in the end as well. He laid out Ziggler with an AA, went to climb the ladder. Vicky Guerrero ran down at this point, I think with a chair. This brought out AJ Lee, who did a horrible John Cena impersonation, mimicking all of his crappy moves, the shoulder tackles, the you can't see me, the five-knuckle shuffle. If there's anything more frightening in this world than John Cena in the ring, it's a female version of John Cena, and that's what we got to see on display here. Cena started climbing the ladder, and AJ started skipping merrily around him as he climbed, and then she grabbed the ladder and tipped it over. And Cena fell across the top rope, turned around, super kick from Dolph Ziggler, place went ape shit for this. And interesting to see Ziggler using the super kick again after I mentioned Big Show on last week's Sound Off doing that interview. And talking about how he and the other vets think that Ziggler should start using Shawn Michaels' super kick as his finish and go babyface with it. He certainly was a babyface in Brooklyn, and he used the super kick. And at that point, he climbed the ladder, he grabbed the briefcase, and the place exploded. And I can tell you from being there, it was a great moment, the perfect way to cap off what I would consider to be an excellent show. Can't say enough good things about it. If I had to nitpick, if there was one thing I really didn't like, it was the sight of John Cena smirking after his loss when the pay-per-view went off the air. I know Ziggler had more to lose than Cena had to gain in this match. But you know what? Cena was still in a pay-per-view main event. He was still fighting for the right to challenge for the world title, which should mean something. But goddamn, man, you just got embarrassed by AJ. She cost you the match, possibly a world title opportunity, and all you can do is smile. Come on, man. Anyway, next month we've got the Royal Rumble match, which is always fun. CM Punk versus The Rock for the WWE Championship, so I am very much looking forward to that show. And if it's anything like TLC, I think it's going to be well worth the price of admission. So, two thumbs up. Let's talk about Monday Night Raw. From Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, this was the annual Slammy Awards show. The Slammys are so completely irrelevant now. I mean, it's... Really, they always have been, but I still liked it when they would actually have an actual ceremony somewhere, not just cut-ins on Raw. I mean, God knows we don't need another hour of television now, so I'd rather they just don't do them at all, especially if from now on we're going to have to deal with Michael Cole telling us every 5 seconds that we're all, you know, it's like we're all brain-dead idiots. We don't know how to download an app. They wanted us to download the new WWE app. You need the app to vote, they said. Here's how you use an app. You see, there's this thing called the App Store. You tap that little icon and you type in WWE, and then you've got to tap the download button. Or else it won't, download. My God, just the mere thought of this new app is making me download in my pants right now. Then every time we go to commercial, you'll have all of 3 minutes to vote on who should win this totally crappy award that means absolutely nothing. You see? Without our app, your life would be completely meaningless. Please download our shiny new app. That's basically what Michael Cole was saying. He was begging us. He was practically on his hands and knees begging people to download this app. And if you already have our app, don't forget to download the update. Oh yeah, the update is even more powerful than the power pack behind Hulk Hogan's left ventricle. Remember the power pack that Hulk Hogan talked about that one time on Saturday night's main event? Power pack full of love and training and vitamins? Fuck the power pack, get the update. I could think of few things worse than having to sit through a show full of Michael Cole talking about this stupid app. You know, food poisoning, passing a kidney stone, a root canal. All of these things would have been preferable over this. So yeah, that's my thoughts on the fan voting aspect of the Slammies this year. They got 150,000 people, apparently, to download the app during the show. So, good for them. I happen to like the app. I'm not knocking the WWE app. I think it's a cool thing to have. But unless it can cook my dinner for me and do my laundry, no app is worth the amount of hype that we had to endure on Monday night. Now, with that out of the way, I did like Raw. I know that some people may think I did not, but I just wanted to get the bad stuff out of the way first. I did like this show. The Ric Flair stuff, which lasted through three segments, probably a total of 30 minutes or so, that was the best thing on the entire show. Yes, Ric Flair returned to Raw, if only for one night. He has not signed a contract with WWE, at least not yet. So do not expect him on television every week. He is available if they need him. I'm guessing it has to do with the ongoing TNA lawsuit. There has been nothing new to report on that lawsuit. It's just kind of there. And I guess by not signing him to a contract, that's kind of their way of getting around the whole thing. They haven't actually signed him. They just invited him to be a special guest. So that's what we got on Monday. Flair was there to present the Slammy for Superstar of the Year. And if you would have guessed that CM Punk, who has been the WWE champion this entire calendar year, would have won, well then, you underestimated the power of the C-Nation. John Cena won Superstar of the Year. And why not? I mean, let's take a look at the year that John Cena has had, shall we? He lost to The Rock at WrestleMania. He got the shit beaten out of him by Brock Lesnar, although he did win in the end. He lost to John Laurinaitis on pay-per-view. He won the Money in the Bank briefcase, and then he promptly failed when he tried to cash it in on Raw 1000. He lost at SummerSlam. He failed to win the title at Night of Champions. He had elbow surgery, so he missed Hell in a Cell altogether. Lost at Survivor Series. Lost at TLC. And on top of all that, the poor guy got a divorce this year. Hell of a year right there for John Cena. And as if we didn't already know how meaningless these things really are, Cena comes out, and he just hands the award over to Ric Flair. A guy that has made a grand total of one appearance on Monday Night Raw all year long. And then Cena vanished. And out came CM Punk and Paul Heyman. Punk and Flair exchanged words. Flair challenged him to a fight. Went to the ring. Punk broke one of his crutches over Flair's back. But he recovered. He gave Punk a thumb to the eye. Put Heyman in the figure four leg lock, which, as I said a few weeks ago, hurts like a bitch. Heyman sold this in hilarious fashion. Paul Heyman is set to wrestle at Madison Square Garden this week. WWE is bringing their annual post-holiday house show to New York City. And because of CM Punk's injury, he is not wrestling on the show. So in place of CM Punk wrestling Ryback, they're actually promoting a Ryback-Paul Heyman match in the main event. Actually, it's a co-main event. I believe the other match is John Cena versus Dolph Ziggler in a steel cage match. I am going to Madison Square Garden. Myself, Brian Blade, and Webmaster Mike are going to MSG on Thursday night this week. And so I am very much looking forward to seeing this. It's got train wreck written all over it. I'm sure it won't be much of an actual match. There'll be a lot of smoke and mirrors, probably mostly comedy. But Paul Heyman is great. He sold this figure four in hilarious fashion. I can only imagine what he will do or how he will sell a beating from Ryback. So as great as TLC was in Brooklyn last weekend, I am very much looking forward to this house show on Thursday night. So I'll be sure to have a report on that next week on the Sound Off. Out came the Shield. They came through the crowd. They went to a commercial break. Came back from commercial, and Kane and Daniel Bryan had appeared. They joined in the fight. It was just mass carnage. And to me, I think maybe that's why I really loved this so much. It just felt chaotic and unpredictable. It didn't feel like the usual WWE formula where, you know, they're about to go to a commercial break. There were a couple points on this show where they just went to commercial. You know, they just faded to black. And then they came back, and there was mass pandemonium going on. It didn't feel formulaic like Raw normally does. It was a break from that, and I liked that. That's what I liked about this, I think, more than anything else. You know, they went to give the Shield went to give Flair the triple powerbomb through the announce table. Ryback came out for the save. He cleaned house on the Shield. And in the end, the babyfaces all celebrated, and they hoisted Ric Flair up on their shoulders. And this was just a great 30 minutes of television. I don't know, you know, what else to say. Say what you want to about Flair personally. I have. A lot of people have. But as a performer in these types of situations, he's still great. And you know, look, the more that Ric Flair appears on Raw, the less special he'll be. That goes for anybody. If Hulk Hogan were to come back, it would be the same thing. At first, Hogan would get these great reactions. And I even think it would be cool to see Hogan back because I've always felt that Hogan belongs in WWE. But after a while, these things just aren't as special anymore. So maybe it's just the fact that it was the first appearance that Flair has made in many years on the show, but this was great. Kofi Kingston won a Slammy Award for his handstand back at the Royal Rumble. Caitlyn beat Eve quickly in a non-title match. Diva Stopwatch had this at 2 minutes and 6 seconds. The New Age Outlaws, who also are now being promoted for that Madison Square Garden house show on Thursday that I'll be at, so I don't think they're wrestling, although they probably could. I'm sure they could still go. We saw the Outlaws in a match at the Wrestle Reunion Convention in Miami as part of WrestleMania weekend earlier this year. Wasn't a long match or anything like that, but they look fine. You know, the Outlaws can still go. But my guess is they're promoting it as more of a, you know, some sort of segment or, oh, God, maybe they'll do a Miz TV segment with them. But, yeah, they'll be at the Garden this Thursday, so I'm looking forward to that. They were on the show. The Outlaws presented the Slammy for Comeback of the Year, which, to nobody's surprise, was won by Jerry the King Lawler. They aired the audio again of him snoring while he had the heart attack on Raw, which is just so goddamn stupid. Why do we have to hear that again? I mean, is it not enough to just show a still image of him laying on a gurney? Idiots. Kofi Kingston beat Tenzai with the Trouble in Paradise. Just remember that. That comes into play again later in the show. AJ Lee and John Cena won the Slammy for Kiss of the Year. Would have been hard for AJ not to win, given that she was nominated 4 different times for kissing 4 different men. This does not include her smooching Dolph Ziggler. Actually, smooch isn't even the right word. She smothered Dolph Ziggler on stage when he came out. They did a deal after AJ won. Her and Vicky were arguing, and Dolph came out, and that's when AJ kissed him. AJ is, she's a little whore, isn't she? She is the Taylor Swift of WWE. So many partners, so little time. Then came the Great Khali against David Otunga. Okay, now they're just fucking with me. They mentioned that Khali now has a Twitter account, which has the potential to be excellent. I've already started following him. You should too. @GreatKhaliSays is his official handle. You'll be able to see such great tweets as, quote, "I am going gym," end quote. Or, there was another tweet where Khali mentioned that he was driving, I guess, on the road with his girl and debating which came first, the chicken or the egg. I would love to debate Great Khali on which came first, the chicken or the egg. I think they should totally add that as part of next year's Fan Access or WrestleMania. I'd pay money for that. The Flair stuff came next. Then came The Rock winning a Slammy for LOL Moment of the Year. He was not there to accept, and so the Philadelphia fans booed him vociferously. They did not like the fact that he was not there. Santino and Tenzai were out there to present the award. Tenzai had this giant ice pack taped to his, it was like strapped to the side of his head. He tripped and fell like the Shockmaster. This was all intended for comedy. I like the idea of Tenzai and Santino as a comedy duo. I'm going to go against the grain here. I see a lot of people saying, oh my God, Tenzai is he's dead. That's it. Tenzai's career is over. Hello? Have you been paying any attention since Tenzai came back earlier this year? He's been dead for months. Now they're finally trying something new with him. Shut up and enjoy it. Tenzai can't possibly go any lower than he's already gone. It's only up from here. I mean, I guess they could cut him. I don't see them doing that. I've always heard that he's well-liked and everything. And look, he's a talented guy. I mean, it seems to me like he may have put on a little more weight. He's been very slow in the ring. You know, he did look kind of impressive to me in some of the matches I watched on YouTube when I you know, go back and watch his Japanese work. Supposedly he got so much better, you know, being in Japan, and we just haven't really seen much of that. But, you know, I think this could work. I think this could definitely work. It's something different. Yeah, the Japanese thing wasn't working. So now they're trying something different. Guy's been dead. Now they're trying to bring him back to life. Let's give it a chance. Let's see what happens. Anything but the Japanese crap is going to work as far as I'm concerned because, you know, they tried it. It failed. Time to try something different. Cody Rhodes beat Sin Cara. The fucking lights were back this week. Unbelievable. Ryback won the Slammy for trending now for the Feed Me More hashtag. Big Show came out for a promo with his gigantic chair. Sheamus came out. He actually offered a handshake to Big Show, which he accepted. That would have been an awesome way for the segment to end. But nope, Big Show started insulting Sheamus. He called him a potato-eating Irishman and a ginger. So Sheamus attacked him and left him laying with a bro kick. I know Big Show is a heel, but this felt so forced to me. Like, okay, I have to start insulting Sheamus for no reason, even though he shook my hand and basically admitted I'm the better man. You know, I have to do this because I'm scripted to do it. Just, I don't know, it just felt phony to me. This set up a Money in the Bank tease as Dolph Ziggler ran out, tried to cash in the briefcase. The place went nuts. They wanted badly for Ziggler to win, but who would come out to foil his plan but John Cena? What a sore loser. What a sore loser John Cena is. Dolph Ziggler beat him fair and square at the pay-per-view. It was AJ who pushed the ladder over, not Dolph. Anyway, Cena beat the crap out of Ziggler, but thankfully the bell never rang, so Dolph still has the briefcase. After the commercial break, Dolph complained to Vicky Guerrero backstage about what just happened, and she made a match for later on. Dolph and AJ against Cena and herself. Hell of a main event right there. Alberto Del Rio, The Miz, and Tommy Dreamer beat 3MB in the longest six-man tag team match I have ever seen. This match would not end. Would not end. Dreamer was over with the crowd. I mean, it's Philadelphia, so, you know, they chanted ECW and all that stuff, and Dreamer's fine. You know, he looked fine. He won with a DDT on Heath Slater. So I guess Heath is back to doing the job on Raw for some of the legends. At the pay-per-view, by the way, 3MB said they would sing live for the first time on this show, and they didn't. And I, for one, am happy that they lied. Ryback won yet another Slammy, this time for Breakout Star of the Year. He invoked the name of the late, great Owen Hart and said enough is enough, and it's time for a change, and he is that change. And then he walked to the ring for a match with Antonio Cesaro. Cesaro ended up taking a powder. He got counted out, walked away. Sucked as a finish, but at least they protected Cesaro by not having Ryback pin him clean with a shell shock. At least they did until SmackDown the next night. Undertaker vs. Triple H at WrestleMania 28, End of an Era, won the Slammy for Match of the Year. I was there. It's a very good match, but not Match of the Year as far as I'm concerned. Actually, the candidates that they nominated for Match of the Year was only four. None of them were bad matches, but there were so many more matches that got left off the list, you know, including the Shield match from the night before. It was a complete joke. Triple H came out to a big ovation, first time on TV with his new haircut. No cast on his arm. His broken arm, by the way. Fans wanted Undertaker. They did not get him. But Triple H did say that we have not seen the last of the dead man. So there's your confirmation. Undertaker will be at WrestleMania 29. Again, supposedly he's already handpicked who he wants his opponent to be. I don't know who that is. CM Punk would certainly be high on my list as far as people that I would think Undertaker would want to work with. Really, there's no hotter heel in WWE right now than CM Punk, but I guess we'll see. Supposedly, and this is the rumor of the week, according to some reputable wrestling sites and newsletters and such, this past week, WrestleMania plans changed dramatically. Not the Triple H Brock Lesnar match, of course. That's Triple H's baby. That's not going to change. He's got to get his win back. But I don't know what that means, that the WrestleMania card has changed. That worries me a bit. But I guess we'll find out where they're going with it. Anyway, Undertaker versus Triple H won the Slammy. And, it's a weird thing because this is the second or third time now that Undertaker has won a Slammy Award for Match of the Year and has not been there to accept it. He just refuses to show up and accept this award. So that tells you what the Undertaker thinks of the Slammies. Backstage, the Shield beat up Tommy Dreamer. Ricardo Rodriguez tried to intervene on his behalf. He got beat up, too. Dreamer suffered a legit nasty gash on his head. He needed stitches for it. If you go on his Twitter account, he's got pictures of it. Nasty, nasty stuff. Not as nasty as R-Truth's leg from the pay-per-view, but still pretty bad. Main event was John Cena, Vicky Guerrero against Dolph Ziggler and AJ Lee. AJ and Vicky really didn't do much. AJ left, and then Vicky left, and Cena and Dolph did their thing. Cena got him in the STF, and all of a sudden AJ reemerged, and she reemerged with Big E Langston from NXT, as Michael Cole informed us. He attacked John Cena, left him laying, while AJ skipped around the ring, and they sure are bringing a lot of the guys up at once from NXT, but at least they're bringing them up in a meaningful role. You know, the Shield, to me, the Shield proved at the pay-per-view they're ready. I have not seen much of Langston, so I don't know, but leaving John Cena laying in your debut is not the worst way in the world to get started. And anyway, aside from the unbearable pimping of their app, this was a really fun show. I enjoyed it. Not a perfect show, but 3 hours long, not everything is going to be a winner. But when Raw was over, it felt like a newsworthy show. It felt like an important show. The Flair segment with The Shield and Ryback and Punk and all that stuff was great television. Some good matches. Good show. I enjoyed it. Two good nights in a row for WWE. And then there was number three, because SmackDown this week was a special commercial-free live super show on Tuesday night. And just some quick notes. I did actually catch SmackDown this week, which is a rare thing for me these days. Dolph Ziggler came out with AJ at the beginning of the show, and Big E Langston, who I guess is their bodyguard now. It was for a Miz TV segment, so I debated at first. Watching this on DVR, I debated if I should just fast forward through it, but I did watch it. And AJ and Dolph were kissing. They were just locking lips the moment they walked out, so in the end, I was right. They did end up together, even though it doesn't make much sense given that only a couple of weeks ago Ziggler berated AJ and referred to her as trash. And it's not like what happened to TLC was all a ruse. You know, Ziggler looked just as shocked as everybody else did on Sunday by what happened, but whatever. I guess she's nuts, so there's no rhyme or reason for how a crazy chick behaves. Segment ended with Langston killing Miz, so to me at least, he is a babyface. Ryback confronted CM Punk on this show, said he wanted his title match on the first Raw of the new year, which is on January 7th. Those of you who do not want spoilers, skip ahead 20 seconds if you don't want to know what happened on Raw this week when they announced the stipulation for this match. They taped the Christmas Eve edition of Raw after SmackDown went off the air and announced that Punk vs. Ryback on January 7th will be a TLC match. And that's a big match to kick off the new year. And I believe The Rock is now scheduled to appear on Raw that night as well. So that's going to be a big show. Back to SmackDown, Ryback pinned Antonio Cesaro, which is fine, given that he is the number one contender for the WWE Championship. Cesaro also lost to John Cena the next night on the Tribute to the Troop show, but that was taped a couple of weeks ago, so I'll give them a pass on that. But still, I don't like Cesaro getting beaten clean on TV two nights in a row. They've done a very good job of protecting him. They obviously, I would think, have big plans for him, and they don't want to beat him down too much. But still, having him get pinned two nights in a row hopefully was just an anomaly, would be a good word for it. The Shield had a big night as well on this show. They took out three people on SmackDown. They destroyed Sin Cara, took out his knee, which is how they're going to explain him being out for a little bit. Sin Cara actually did have knee surgery this week. I don't think it was a serious operation. I'm not quite sure exactly what kind of surgery it was, but I don't think he'll be out for too long, but it is a legitimate injury. He's been wrestling with it for a while. On Twitter, Sin Cara actually tweeted that he was having, quote, mini surgery on his knee. Didn't explain exactly what mini surgery meant. I guess that's what you call surgery on a short person, I guess. I don't know. The Shield beat up Rey Mysterio backstage, although we never actually saw the attack. They came out during Sin Cara's match with Damian Sandow, and they threw Rey Mysterio's mask into the ring at Sin Cara. And we were told that Mysterio had sustained a serious neck injury, which apparently is not true. I don't think Rey is actually hurt, but if the plan is to still do a Rey vs. Sin Cara match at WrestleMania, maybe the storyline could be that, you know, each man is pissed at how often the other gets hurt, and they decide to fight each other. Anyway, Shield gave Brodus Clay a triple team powerbomb after Brodus had beaten Brad Maddox, so three victims on SmackDown for the Shield. Tenzai, as I mentioned earlier, total comedy character now. He lost to Santino. And again, I'm in favor of Tenzai as a comedy babyface because Tenzai as a menacing heel has been perhaps the biggest fail of 2012. So let him be the laughingstock for a few weeks. Build some sympathy for the big guy. And then he can do the turn. He can make it official. I don't know if you want to make Tenzai and Santino an official team. I know Zack Ryder's been doing some teaming with Santino. They even came up with a name for them, Team Cobro. So I don't know if that's the direction they want to go in, but again, I am in favor of doing something different with Tenzai. I'm in favor of him showing more personality. You know, he actually spoke on Raw this week. They were doing a comedy bit where Santino made reference to a teleprompter, and Tenzai, you know, barked back at him. He said, "There's no teleprompter there." And that's like, I know it's not the first time he's spoken, but he hasn't exactly said much since he came back to WWE. I'd like to hear him talk more. I'd like to hear him do a normal promo and not talk in Japanese, and maybe people start to get into him. You know, I always thought to myself, you know, Matt Morgan had teased that he was going to come back to WWE. His contract, I think, expired. He was gone. He was off TV for several weeks. And he would go on Twitter and put these cryptic tweets up that led people to think he was coming back. And, you know, I felt like, did WWE really need Matt Morgan? Matt Morgan, quite frankly, I'm sure he's a nice guy. I've never met him. He's not that good. He's just big. And you could say the same thing about Tenzai. I heard Tenzai was really, really good, and I haven't exactly seen that from him since he's been back. Maybe the gimmick was holding him back. Maybe he just needs to lose a little bit of weight. Maybe he let himself go a little bit. I don't know. But Tenzai, you know, Matt Morgan is a legit 7 feet tall. Tenzai is not, but Tenzai's still a big guy. He's still got to be about 6'7", 6'8". Do we really need another big guy on the roster just for the sake of having a big guy? Do something with Tenzai. You don't need Matt Morgan. You don't need these guys. Do something with the people you have already. Maybe they will now with Tenzai. We'll see. Main event was Cena and Sheamus against Big Show and Dolph Ziggler. Big E Langston interfered for the finish, gave Cena his move. So a total rehash of the finish from Monday night. Another shitty finishing move given to a new guy. Just what we need. I'm on a crusade, in case you couldn't tell, against shitty finishing maneuvers. I'm still trying to figure out what damage this move that Langston did is supposed to inflict on his opponent. Is it like damage to your ribs? Does it just knock the wind out of you? It's a legitimate question. I seriously have no idea. If anybody knows, let me know. So that was SmackDown. That's really all you need to know about the show from Tuesday night. Not exactly as good as Raw. Definitely not as good as the pay-per-view, although I didn't expect it to be. But that's about where I reached my limit of the week for WWE. Like I said, I could not watch Tribute to the Troops or Main Event. I just couldn't bring myself to do it, especially knowing I had two more hours of wrestling on Thursday with TNA, Impact Wrestling, another taped show. I think it was taped about 2 weeks ago. Impact was a good show. Nothing really out of the ordinary. They had a world championship match in the main event, but it just didn't feel all that special for some reason. I don't know what it was. Match itself was pretty good. Jeff Hardy retained the title over Austin Aries when Bobby Roode interfered and attacked Aries. I presume this sets up a three-way at the next pay-per-view, whatever it's called. Devon retained his television title over Kurt Angle after one of the masked men from Aces and Eights ran in and hit Angle with a pipe, knocked him out. Angle had Samoa Joe, Garrett Bischoff, and Wes Briscoe out there to watch his back. And they failed in their task. Let's put it that way. That's really all they were out there for. The only thing that Joe, Bischoff, and Briscoe were required to do was watch Kurt Angle's back. And they couldn't even do that. It's just hilarious to me. These men have no future in the protection business if this wrestling gig doesn't work out for them. Matt Morgan with cape. Still walking around with Hulk Hogan's cape from Shea Stadium. He and Joey Ryan beat Rob Van Dam and Kenny King when Joey Ryan pinned RVD. Finish was pretty funny. Morgan was threatening to deliver the carbon footprint, and Kenny King was kind of standing in the middle of the ring, basically between Morgan and RVD. RVD was kind of dazed in the corner. Well, what is RVD not dazed? But he was dazed in the corner. Kenny King is between the two of them. And Kenny King ponders this situation for a moment. He knows the kick is coming, and he chooses to flash a peace sign, and he bails, which allows Matt Morgan to kick his partner square in the face. And then on the outside, Kenny King was acting all concerned for Rob Van Dam's well-being, but really he was just full of shit. Hulk Hogan came out for a promo. He told us they were doing online voting to determine the TNA Superstar of the Year, and they would reveal the winner on January 3rd. Thank God it's online voting and not through an app. Aces and Eights interrupted. Devon said that in 2013 they were going to accomplish their goals. I'd still love to know what these goals are, by the way. They still haven't spelled that out for us. They were about to kick Hogan's ass, or should I say Hulk Hogan was about to kick all of their asses, when Bully Ray sprinted down to the ring, chased away Aces and Eights. This right here and what happened at the end of the show are proof that Bully Ray is with Aces and Eights. I mean, I've been saying this for months now, but I'm convinced of it now. Hogan did not seem very grateful for the help, since, yet again, he would have single-handedly, I'm sure, been able to take care of Aces and Eights all by himself. So instead of thanking Bully Ray, he just walked off, and this made Bully very sad. Jeff Hardy, backstage, gave us his thoughts, and this time, his mouth was moving as he spoke. Hallelujah! Somebody listened. We had a segment where Frankie Kazarian, one half of the best damn tag team in all of wrestling, came out to honor his partner, Christopher Daniels. He had a Christmas tree in the ring. Unfortunately, it was not wrapped in barbed wire. A throne, so that Daniels can sit on it. He had presents and all sorts of gifts. He's like the best tag team partner ever. And then he brought out Santa Claus, and they talked about being naughty or nice and such, and they actually gave Santa a gift. That's how great these guys are. They gave Santa Claus a gift, not the other way around. They gave Santa the gift of Zubaz pants. I so wish somebody would get me that gift for Christmas. I hope everybody's listening out there. If you could find a pair of Zubaz pants, send them my way. This brought out James Storm, who has every right to be upset with Santa. Poor bastard asked him for a push last year, and Santa took a big old dump in that stocking, didn't he? In the end, Storm superkicked Santa. And that was that. Completely pointless segment, but Bad Influence was great in their roles here. They made this bearable. Wasn't quite as bad as Miz TV, let's put it that way. They aired another 1-3-13 vignette hyping the January 3rd show, and this time they just decided, fuck it, we're just going to come out and tell people what it's for. It is, in fact, the return of Sting. Sting promised revenge on Aces and Eights, and I must say, for a 53-year-old who was bashed repeatedly all over his body with a hammer, he has incredible recuperative powers. I'd certainly be afraid if I were Aces and Eights. I mean, did these guys even see the movie The Crow? You couldn't kill that guy. He just kept coming back until he killed each one of the bad guys. I'd be very worried if I were them. Tara beat Mickie James to retain the Knockouts title. That was that. Then we got another Joseph Park Ohio Valley Wrestling training vignette. This time, Danny Davis was beside himself with anger over what a poor excuse for a wrestler Joe Park was. I would love to see Danny Davis in the ring watching John Cena do moves. Oh, what fun that would be. Poor Joe Park got busted open by one of the other very green, apparently, students. And when he saw his own blood, he snapped. He gave the other guy a black hole slam. And he shrieked like his brother Abyss would. Remember, they're two totally different people. And apparently nobody cares anymore about Abyss. You don't hear about Abyss anymore. Abyss is one of those TNA originals. You know, he's been there from the very beginning, like AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels and James Storm and Bobby Roode. Abyss is one of the original TNA guys. He put his body through hell. You'd think they'd be more concerned about his whereabouts and his well-being, but nobody seems to give a shit. He's been left to die somewhere, apparently. I already mentioned Jeff Hardy beat Austin Aries in the main event. Final segment of the show was Hulk Hogan leaving the building. He was being pestered by some really obnoxious interviewer. I guess that's like their version of TMZ, I guess. I don't know. Hulk's about to get into his car. He looks up, and what does he see but Bully Ray and his daughter smooching in the parking garage. They're up against a car, and they're kissing, and they're making out. It's like a passionate makeout session. And so angered by this was Hulk Hogan that he got into his car and drove away. Yep. Because I know that's how most fathers would handle a situation like that. Actually, most fathers would probably get into their car and proceed to run down the man with their car. So Hulk was feeling awfully charitable this week. Must have been the festive holiday mood that he was in. By the way, Hulk Hogan was interviewed by The Guardian newspaper in the UK this week for their celebrity Christmas wish list feature, and Hogan claimed that he needs one more surgery on his right knee, not his back, and after he has that surgery, he claims, he is going to compete for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. This is what he said. He says he wants to be the champion at 59 years of age. So that's sure to get people talking. And that's all I take that as, by the way. It's just Hulk Hogan spewing bullshit. Oh, I mean, Hogan is great at that. I give him a lot of credit because, again, the interviewer in The Guardian, they don't know any better. So Hogan's trying to make news. He's telling them that at 59 years of age, he wants to wrestle and win another world title. It's not going to happen, but he can say it if he wants to. I highly doubt Hogan would even do a match. Title match or non-title at this point. The fact that he did no wrestling at all in 2012 speaks volumes about his physical condition. I mean, just watching him walk to the ring every week on Impact, it's just a struggle for the guy. I mean, he keeps himself in great shape, don't get me wrong, but there ain't no way he's wrestling for the title. Not if they know what's good for them. I mean, they could try to pop a number off it, I guess. But to me, you're doing a disservice to the fans if you promote a pay-per-view main event. There's a certain level of expectations, I think, that people have for a pay-per-view main event. And Hulk Hogan is just, he's not able to perform at that level anymore. I wouldn't mind seeing Hogan wrestle a special match from time to time if he was physically able to do it. But, I mean, that poor guy, all the crap that he's been through with his back, forget his knees and his neck and every other part of his body. His hip, he's had a couple of hip replacements, just his back. I mean, the guy has been through agony. Why would you want to risk it? You know, I don't want to see him, crippled in a wheelchair in his waning years. Believe me, back pain and neck pain are two of the worst things you could possibly experience. I mean, I've had back spasms before and I wanted to die. I can only imagine, you look at the scars on Hogan's back, he has this device that was implanted in one of the surgeries into his back to, like, give off little electrical impulses. I mean, this is what the guy has gone through just so he can walk. To me, taking bumps in the ring and wrestling would be the absolute last thing that he should be thinking about. So anyway, I don't buy it for a second. It's just Hogan trying to get people talking, so it may be the big story, I guess, in the next day or two. You may see headlines about it, but don't buy into it. So, with that out of the way, let's get to your questions and shout-outs, because we're an hour in, and I've got a lot more to get to here. I'm going to try to get to all of these. Email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. That is still the place to be if you want to send questions, comments, shout-outs, death threats, all that stuff. Ant writes in, says, my girlfriend and I are getting married on December 22nd. Could you give a shout-out to the new Mr. and Mrs. Edge? That really is our last name, he says. I love her and can't wait to spend my life with her and grow old with her. So, my best to the two of you. You can listen to the sound-off together, too, by the way. Don't forget that. Gabriel would like a shout-out for his new baby nephew, Giovanni, who was born last Saturday, all 6 pounds of him. He was born a month early, and luckily his mother was able to induce, so they did not have to perform a C-section. Well, I'm a C-section baby. What's so bad about that? Anyway, Gabriel says, he truly came at the right time for my family, our little blessing in light of the recent tragedy. I plan to be a good uncle and steer him on the straight and narrow to one day be a little Solomonster fan and guide him away from the spinny belt lovers of the world. So that comes from Gabriel. Robin, listener since episode 109, with the continual and somewhat depressing decline of WWE, may it be time to bring in a completely fresh group of writers, perhaps some Hollywood or TV people? Well, they already have people from TV and Hollywood on the writing staff, so I don't think that's the answer. In my opinion, that's a contributing factor to what's wrong with the company today. You know, when you bring in these people on the outside who perhaps have never even been wrestling fans, they don't even know what wrestling is, you know, it gets us further and further away from what wrestling ought to be, which is not a good thing. Not that their ideas aren't welcome, you know, to help spice things up. I don't want to say that these people don't have any good ideas. You know, for all I know, what we saw at the TLC pay-per-view, the Flair segment on Raw Monday, maybe it was the brainchild of one of their Hollywood people that they have on their writing staff. I don't know. But these people should not be dictating what happens on television every week. They can contribute ideas, but I'm still a believer that wrestling, you know, traditionally, as it was booked, the stuff that I saw when I was a kid on TV, it worked for a reason. It worked then, it can work now. Let's try to get closer to that, not get further away from it. Chris writes in, Big E Langston debuted as AJ's heavy on Raw. Don't you think this would have been an effective way to bring back Jack Swagger? A serious attack on the top guy would make people look at him strongly and forget about how much of a joke he was when he left. You know, it's funny to me how John Cena is still looked at as the top guy, even with CM Punk as WWE champion for the entire year. I just find that funny. I'm not even saying Chris is wrong in saying that. I'm just saying it seems kind of backwards to me. But anyway, it's weird. This was the second email I got this week talking about Swagger for this role instead of Langston. Evan also emailed me asking how I would reintroduce Jack Swagger. You know, Evan said he would have done it maybe as a babyface, either having him win the Rumble or maybe returning on, like, the July 4th episode of SmackDown and beating Antonio Cesaro for the U.S. title. I think we'll see Swagger way before July. But that doesn't mean you couldn't still do a deal where Cesaro is, let's say, running down the U.S. and out comes the All-American American to beat him for the championship. You could still do that. I had been thinking that a good role for Swagger might be as a heavy, as you referred to Big E Langston, as part of some Paul Heyman faction. But, you know, the more I think about it, he might be better off returning as a babyface. To me, that'll freshen him up a little bit more. Having him attack John Cena feels like a rehash to me, since we've seen him and Cena have a ton of matches against each other, usually with Swagger on the losing end. Plus, that would put Swagger right back with Dolph Ziggler, and to me, that partnership has run its course. I don't need to see the two of them together again. No matter how he comes back, though, he's got to look strong. Heel or face, doesn't matter. No more losing streaks. No more comedy crap. He has to go on a winning streak. He has to be made to look strong. And not speak, either. That lisp doesn't help him any. You know, when my non-wrestling friend came to an event with me once and heard Jack Swagger speak for the very first time, he just burst out laughing. Now, my friend is also an asshole, so that may be part of it. But, at least at first, I think Silent But Deadly would actually be a pretty good idea for Jack Swagger. He doesn't have to speak. Just come out and beat people up. You know, maybe stand up to the Shield or something. But he has to look strong in whatever he does, or else he's going to be dead in the water. Ash writes in, Hey, Solomonster, with Fandango's debut around the corner, do you think anybody remembers that Johnny Curtis earned a tag team title shot with R-Truth from winning NXT, and will WWE ever be bothered to actually do the match? Actually, I think Fandango is already done before he had a chance to begin. I haven't seen any more vignettes for him in a couple of weeks. Actually, several weeks now. So it appears that Fandango may be no more. Maybe it was for the better, I don't know. But to answer your question, he already got his title match on a recent episode of NXT against Kane and Daniel Bryan. It went pretty much unnoticed, obviously. He did not team with R-Truth for the match. He actually teamed up with Michael McGillicuddy. But it was explained on commentary, apparently, by Jim Ross that this was, in fact, Johnny Curtis's long-anticipated title shot that he earned the previous year. So much for that. David from Wisconsin, my girlfriend and I were discussing all of the different classes that she needs to take to complete college. Somehow, the conversation turned to wrestling. My question is, if there was a pro wrestling degree that you could get, like a bachelor's degree in wrestling or wrestling history, what do you think would be the most important points of wrestling to dedicate classes to? What would your four-year wrestling classes look like? You know, the most important course, obviously, easily, and I think many people in wrestling could use a refresher course in this, would be Pro Wrestling 101. And Professor Solomonster's syllabus would be all about logic, logic, logic. Why logic matters in pro wrestling. Why wins and losses matter, or should still matter in pro wrestling. I mean, I could go on forever and a day about this, and I'm not even in wrestling. This is coming from the perspective of a fan. I'm sure you could take any number of people who are actually in the wrestling business right now, as we speak, be it the wrestlers themselves, road agents, whoever. They could do a much better job of explaining what works and what doesn't and where the focus should really be. Believe me, there's a lot of people behind the scenes, for example, in WWE, people perhaps who have been in production meetings and writing meetings over the years who bite their lip and say not one single word, even though they disagree completely with the direction that things are going in, because they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to make waves. They want to protect their job, and I get that, but there are plenty of smart people in that company who know how things should be, whether they want to admit it or not, and those are the people I'd love to hear from. Stephen from the Isle of Man, UK, longtime listener, second-time emailer, was recently looking up the history of WWE's version of the ECW world title and came across the fact that Christian was the longest-reigning champion in this era of ECW. This led me to think about Christian's overall impact on WWE during his second run with the company. I was wondering if you could share with us your views on Christian since he returned and where you see him going in the next few years. I made it clear on the sound off when Christian first came back to WWE in 2009 that I thought it was a mistake to put him on the ECW brand. He was originally supposed to be revealed as the mystery man terrorizing Jeff Hardy and then interfere in his title match with Edge at the Royal Rumble and I presume cost him the championship. And then what happened is word leaked out on the internet. Vince McMahon flipped his lid, went ballistic. And he wanted to swerve everybody because he assumed, oh, everybody knows what's going to happen, so now we have to change plans. And instead, they turned Matt Hardy, who turned on his brother. Now, it was great for the younger guys who got to work with Christian on the ECW brand. You know, Ezekiel Jackson, I remember, worked the program with him for the title. But it didn't do Christian's career any favors to be relegated to the C show, which is what ECW was. You know, Raw's always been the A show. Then SmackDown, and at that time, ECW was the third brand. It really was treated in many ways like a third-rate brand. But fast forward 2 years, and Christian had arguably the best and most lucrative year of his career. He won the World Heavyweight title for the first time. He ended up winning it a second time. And he had the feud of the year with Randy Orton. As far as I'm concerned, those guys had great chemistry from the very first match they had on SmackDown. You know, now after a while, it got a little tiresome. It was Randy Orton and Christian, it seemed like, every single week. They had like a million matches. Same can be said for Sheamus and Del Rio, or Orton and Del Rio this year. The difference is, Christian and Orton, they stole the show every time they went out there. Those guys were so great together. That, to me, is what defines Christian's second run and makes it a success. Unfortunately, he's been hurt much of the past year. He's missed a lot of time. He's out right now with some sort of injury. I don't think he's due back for another 3 or 4 weeks. You know, he's getting older. I think Christian had his last big run last year. I don't see Vince McMahon giving him another go at the world title or anything like that. And given the injuries, it makes me wonder what his future is. I mean, hopefully it's nothing serious. He'll, you know, again, he'll come back and hopefully he'll be healthy. But if Christian were to retire in the next couple of years, wouldn't shock me. Remember, he was part of that whole TLC generation. The Edge and Christian, the Hardys, the Dudleys, the punishment that they put their bodies through in those ladder matches. I mean, it catches up to you. His best friend had to retire at 38 because of all the abuse that he took. So I think he'll be one of these guys they use to work with all the young talent they have. And they've been calling a lot of young guys up lately from NXT. You know. Him and Seth Rollins or Christian maybe and Dean Ambrose, I'm sure they could have some kick-ass matches. And that may be the best role for him at this point. Maybe he takes a more active role down in NXT as a trainer if that's something they want to use him for. Maybe he's interested in doing that. Christian's a great wrestler. I'm sure he can offer some very valuable insight, but I think his best run is behind him now. Matt I. writes in, can you educate me on the different eras in wrestling, mainly WWE, from the 1980s until today. More specifically, how would you categorize each era, starting with the Hogan rise in the 80s? Can you be specific when explaining each era? For example, what does it mean? When did it begin? Etc., etc. When you get to the Ruthless Aggression era, can you please explain the difference between that era and the Attitude era? I'm not sure there is one. So that comes from Matt. I'll try to keep this brief, and this may just be my take on things. Again, other people may have their own interpretations of the different eras in WWE history. You have some very distinct eras dating back to the Bruno era, Bruno Sammartino, which is really, I think, a good chunk of the 1960s and much of the 70s. Superstar Billy Graham was hot. You know, he had a run with the title, but he was champion for like 10 months. So that doesn't exactly count as an era. Then you have the Backlund era. Bob Backlund was the top star. He held the title for like 5-plus years. Then you have the Hogan era, which Hogan himself would probably tell you never actually ended. It's still going on. But realistically, the Hogan era in WWF ended when he left in 1992. You know, I know he came back the following year, but he was gone a few months later. And he really felt kind of out of place at that time in WWF in 1993. I mean, you know, now to walk this back a bit, when the Hogan era began, really from 84, I'd say, to 86, that was the rock and wrestling era, which, again, was part of the Hogan era. But 84 to 86 is what I would really refer to as the rock and wrestling era. That was the era that transformed the business. It created the juggernaut that is Vince McMahon. It was a gamble. It paid off. You fast forward a little bit, 1993, 94. You have the New Generation era, which is when Vince decided it was time to push new guys. Guys like Hogan and Savage were old. They were washed up in his eyes. In fact, that's the main reason Randy Savage left in 94 and jumped ship to WCW. Besides the money, I'm sure. You know, he wanted to wrestle more often. I'm not even saying Savage wanted to be the top star. But, you know, I've heard that it was more just an issue of Savage wanted to wrestle. You know, that's really what he wanted. More so than announcing, which is what he was relegated to at that point. In fact, I think two SummerSlams in a row, I think SummerSlam 93 and 94, he had some roles like he was like the host, or I think they called him the master of ceremonies or something. He didn't even have a match. He was like the host of the show. He would be the equivalent of what the guest hosts, I guess, would have been in this era of Raw. And Savage was not happy with that, you know. Vince saw Savage as more of an announcer and an ambassador to the company, and Savage felt like he still had a run left in him. And it was also the clean era, if you will, at that point, because WWF had instituted very stringent drug testing in 1992, and everybody suddenly deflated. They either deflated or they vanished, which was kind of weird. You know, the really big jacked up guys like, you know, the Warlord and people like that, all of a sudden they mysteriously disappeared. And other guys noticeably got smaller on TV. There were some guys like Lex Luger and Davey Boy Smith who somehow, you know, they managed to cheat the system. But by and large, you didn't have the jacked up physiques on TV that you were used to seeing. And it was the rise of guys like Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels who benefited from it. You know, they were the new generation. And I would say that ended in 1997, which I would argue is where the Attitude Era officially began. It was still early in its infancy, but when Bret Hart shoved down Vince McMahon the week before WrestleMania 13 and started cursing up a storm on live television, Attitude was born. And I would even argue the seeds of the Attitude Era were planted as early as the fall of 1996 when Sid beat Shawn Michaels for the title at Survivor Series. And you had this nucleus of guys that hated each other. It was this palpable hatred. You could just watch the show and tell just by watching through the television screen, these guys really don't like each other very much. You know? And the championship, this is the most important thing here. The WWF title was the most important thing in the world to all of these guys. That was the common denominator that kind of brought them all together. They wanted badly to be the champion. They wanted to be the number one guy. That was what was important to them. The title wasn't a joke. It wasn't an afterthought. It meant something. And that nucleus was Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels. Of course, Bret and Shawn hated each other for real. Steve Austin, Psycho Sid, and The Undertaker. I mean, maybe you could throw Vader in there. Probably not, though. But that was it. Those are your core guys at the time who were feuding. So Attitude was born at that point and lasted until Steve Austin shook hands with Vince McMahon at WrestleMania 17. That launched us into the Alliance era. And then the following year, right around mid-year, is when the Ruthless Aggression era began. And I don't know that I can pinpoint exactly when the Ruthless Aggression era ended, but after that was the PG era, which kicked off in 2008. And really, we're still in it. We're still in the PG era now. Some people may refer to the current... I've heard people refer to the current era as the reality era. I'm not even sure what the hell that means. To me, there's hardly anything real about much of what we see these days on WWE television. I mean, aside from the PG aspect, I still think WWE is trying to find itself. I don't know that we are in any particular kind of era right now, per se. And as far as what differentiates the Attitude Era from the Ruthless Aggression Era, to me, Attitude was about the wacky characters. It was about this feeling of absolute mayhem and carnage, about the competition, the war between WWF and WCW. Once WCW died, you didn't have that anymore. You didn't have that sense of urgency. That was one element missing from the Ruthless Aggression Era. But more importantly, the Ruthless Aggression Era was about what Vince McMahon on television came out and said he intended for it to be. It was about young guys stepping up and creating opportunities for themselves. I think that's basically how he said it on television. John Cena, you know, making his debut on SmackDown and shouting Ruthless Aggression into the microphone and then going after Kurt Angle is a prime example of it. It was about great wrestling, which, as great as the Attitude Era was, if you're a fan of great technical wrestling, let's be honest, you didn't really get a lot of that back then. You did maybe on WCW Monday Nitro with the Cruiserweights and Dean Malenko and Chris Jericho and Rey Mysterio and Eddie Guerrero and guys like that, and even, you know, Alex Wright and Billy Kidman and some of those guys. But if we're talking WWE, WWF, you go back and watch those Raws in 98, 99, they're a lot of fun to watch. I'll watch them from time to time on demand, WWE Classics. They're fun. But you don't watch them expecting to see great wrestling matches, because those were few and far between. It was more about the characters. Austin versus McMahon, DX against the Nation, all that stuff. In the Ruthless Aggression era, you had that period of the SmackDown 6 when Paul Heyman was booking, and SmackDown was arguably the A-show for a period of time. You know, when Triple H was on top of the world on Raw as the world champion, the show was dreadful. I know some people like that. They felt that Triple H made the title mean something. I thought it was god-awful. I thought it was boring as shit. But on SmackDown, you had Brock Lesnar, you had Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, Chris Jericho, Shelton Benjamin, Charlie Haas, Edge, all these great talents just tearing it up every single week, having great matches. That's what defines the Ruthless Aggression era for me. Less cartoony, over-the-top gimmicks, aside from Mr. America, and less gratuitous sex and profanity, and just more of a reliance on great action. Ross from London, UK, congratulations on a great podcast, first and foremost. Pro wrestling sure has its dark days, and it's great to have your podcast to keep me interested in wrestling. I myself am a Paul Heyman guy, and my question for you is, do you think Paul E. would have done a better job with WCW if he had landed Eric Bischoff's gig back in 94 and had the unlimited resources that Ted Turner provided? It would be great to have you mention me on your next Sound Off, as I have been a listener since episode 183 and have only now bucked up the courage to write in. So that comes from Ross. I don't bite, Ross, so no need to be afraid. It's a great question. I think Paul E. would have done a fine job with WCW back in 94. I know, if nothing else, Steve Austin would have been positioned as a top guy with Heyman in charge. He wouldn't have been booked to lose in 30 seconds on pay-per-view to Hacksaw Jim Duggan. I know he would have brought in men like Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero and Chris Jericho and Rey Mysterio, just like he did in ECW, only in WCW they actually would have been pushed as somebodies instead of just being thrown on TV to fill time between NWO segments. But then there's the other side of the coin. You know, were it not for Eric Bischoff, let's say borrowing, shall we say, an idea that he first saw in Japan, which would later become the NWO. Who knows where the wrestling business would be today? Who knows if Nitro would have grown to become as big as it did? It may not have. Steve Austin may never have gone to the WWF and gotten over a Stone Cold, which means there may never have been an Attitude Era. Because without Stone Cold, there is no Attitude Era. I mean, I know the seeds for it, as I said before, I think the seeds for it were planted in late 96, and you had Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and all that. Austin was also part of that. And it never would have grown into being what it was if the Stone Cold character wasn't there. So, you know, Vince McMahon may never have become an on-screen heel. Or if he did, he may not have had anybody to play off of like he did with Steve Austin. I mean, there's a lot of what-if questions that go along with it. And I just look back at that, and I'm actually thankful. I'm thankful things worked out the way they did because, you know, in the end, I think, at least for that time period, I don't think anybody's complaining. I think things worked out pretty well. Richard Knox from Northern Ireland. Hey, Solomonster, just wondering if I can get a birthday shout-out. I turned 18 on the 19th of December and would love a shout-out, so happy birthday, Richard. I don't know how it is over in Northern Ireland, but if you lived here in New York, you would now be of legal age to be AJ Lee's next boy toy. Anyway, Richard wants to know, in my opinion, what pay-per-view in recent years has had the most potential to be a great show but failed to deliver? WrestleMania 27. Without question. First, going to get me going here on this question here. First, they bumped Sheamus versus Daniel Bryan from the pay-per-view, okay, which would have been an awesome match. That was disappointing. Then they booked the match between Jerry Lawler and Michael Cole, which, believe it or not, I was actually kind of looking forward to it. It was Lawler's first ever WrestleMania match. Big deal to him. And they booked Michael Cole to dominate, I mean, I'd say 75% of the match. I mean, seriously, go back and watch that match. Lawler had to sell for Michael Cole for extended periods of time. Just minutes on end. They gave Cole real offense here, not like a few comedy spots. And then in the end, Lawler wins, and they do the dumb anonymous GM deal where he reverses the decision, and Michael Cole gets the win. I mean, whoever booked that match, and I remember hearing, I think it may have been Dean Malenko, actually, who got reamed out afterwards because the match sucked the life out of the Georgia Dome. It was that bad. Whoever laid that match out should be ashamed. And then we had the main event. John Cena against The Miz. Yes, The Miz in a WrestleMania main event. And it was every bit as awful as you would expect it to be. And it's not just Miz's fault. You know, John Cena deserves some blame, too. The match sucked. Probably the worst main event in WrestleMania history. And don't give me the LT versus Bam Bam bullshit, because you knew that match would suck going in. And if anything, Lawrence Taylor kind of impressed me in that match. You know, he did some things that I didn't expect him to do. And that match was meant to be a special attraction, not just a regular match. The only reason Miz headlined WrestleMania was so that Rock could do a run-in to help set up the following year's WrestleMania main event. And when you book a WrestleMania main event simply as a way to set up next year's main event, I'm sorry, but that sucks. I thought they would do more with Rock on that show. It was very disappointing, actually, how little he really did. You know, he just beat up Miz, the champion, when the match was over, and posed, and that was it. Just very underwhelming. There was an awesome Undertaker-Triple H match on that show, but it just was not enough to save it. WrestleMania 27, to me, very big disappointment. So, that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. A lot of great questions. Sorry to those of you who I was not able to get to. I did take about an hour and a half this week to sit here and write back to people who I had not gotten back to. And keep sending in those questions. I read them all. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. If you want to send a shout-out that perhaps we'll get on the air, that's the same email address, TheSolomonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter. @Solomonster is my handle as we rapidly approach 1,900 followers and counting. And Facebook.com/TheSolomonster. No spaces, all one word. That's a shortcut to our official Facebook profile page. You can send me a friend request, and I will approve you. It's always a good time there. And you can subscribe to The Sound Off in iTunes for free and leave a review for the show as well. So I think that covers all the important bases. Next weekend, of course, is New Year's weekend. I am planning on doing a show as usual, and I'm debating what I will do for that show. Obviously, I'll have some thoughts. Like I said, I'll be at Madison Square Garden yet another WWE show coming up this Thursday, so I'll have some thoughts on that, I'm sure. Ryback versus Paul Heyman. In some sick, twisted way, I'm actually kind of looking forward to that. And I may do a year-end review type thing. I did a year-end review show last year that just, it was exhausting. I don't know if I'm going to do a full show like that again. I may have some thoughts on some things that happened this year. We'll see what happens. So that'll be episode 252 next weekend. And that about wraps it up here. Again, I want to take this opportunity to wish all of you who celebrate a very Merry Christmas. Have a happy holiday. I will be back here next weekend for a special year-end edition of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com. So until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy the holiday week, and hopefully some time off from work, as I will. And we will see you right back here next weekend. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.